Yeah, you're as surprised as I am. Stephen is out sick this afternoon, and so he asked me to step in on somewhat short notice. So to comfort you all just a little bit, this is a lesson I've done before. Not so much comfort to the young adults. This is a lesson that they heard about 2 weeks ago. I had done this lesson at reunion about a month and a half ago, and I was scheduled to do the young adult class, and I just didn't come up with anything that I liked better, so that's what I talked about. But I said, you know, when you see me down to preach sometime, you can visit somewhere else. Well, it was too short notice to find out, and I wasn't expecting it to be just 2 weeks later. At any rate, if I can get you all, turn to your Bibles in, let's see, the first passage I think will need to be, let's see, I think we want to go to the book of Luke. Yes, let's go to the book of Luke first. I'll give you the passage in particular here in just a moment. Well, it's happened a lot in the last few years. We turn on the news and we hear about someone who has gone in and shot up a school, or has opened fire on some employees of a business somewhere, or the one in Las Vegas last year where that fellow rained down bullets on those concert goers. And in some of those occasions, I should back up and say first, the first question we ask is why? You know, why? Why would somebody do such a thing? How could somebody talk themselves into doing such a thing? And we typically have three ways that we can answer that question. Sometimes the people are bold enough that they want you to know exactly why they did what they did. And so they leave something of a manifesto, write a long note, or leave some video on social media somewhere. And while we can look at those cases and say, well, I guess I understand why they did it, I just can't relate to it. I certainly can't condone those things, but there's not really any mystery as to why. Others, they don't intend to leave a paper trail, if you will, but by looking at social media posts and phone records, talking to friends and neighbors and family members, we can pretty well get an idea of what was motivating the guy. There may be a few questions left, but we pretty well can put the pieces together. But like with this guy in Las Vegas, what was it? We still don't really know. And so we wonder. People talk about the assassin of John F. Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, why did he do what he did? Still people debating that decades later. And we may never entirely know on some of these kind of things. Well, there's a fella in the Bible who he's not somebody that we really have to debate at all. We're not left to wonder. In fact, he's not even in that category where we think, well, we pretty well understand, but there are a few details missing. No, we know exactly why he did what he did, because the Bible tells us. And yet people wonder, why did Judas do it? How did a man who spent 3 years in the company of the Son of God, how could he somehow talk himself into the idea that he could betray him and somehow get away with that, somehow be spared his life? Well, as it happens, in the last couple of years, I've heard a couple of alternatives as some alternative, and I'll just go ahead and spoil it for you, erroneous theories, I think, as to why Judas did what he did. And so you may be asking, well, Brad, if these are erroneous, why are we gonna talk about them? We're gonna talk about these two erroneous theories, and then we're gonna look at what the Bible actually has to say. I mean, it takes all of two passages to fully settle this. And so why are we gonna talk about these first two theories? Well, this is a gospel sermon. Gospel sermon has to have 3 points. And so we're not savages here. We're gonna have 3 points to that. No. But to be serious though, have you ever been having a conversation with somebody on a Bible topic and they just come out of nowhere with something you've never heard before, and you have one of those mental speed bump moments where you think, you sort of blink your eyes and you hesitate and you, what did you say? And so I'd like to inoculate you against that sort of thing. Perhaps you've never heard these points before. Also, there are a couple of tangential things that we can look at in the Bible as we look at these two theories. But finally, I think with these two alternative theories as foils, I think when we get to what the Bible actually has to say, and most if not all of you know what the answer is here, but when we get to what the Bible actually has to say about Judas's point, about his motive rather, I think there's a really sobering lesson in that. Well, with that, let's examine rather this first theory. the first theory, Judas was a zealot. And so I'm going to paraphrase what I've heard a couple of. It's kind of funny. Within the space of about 2 weeks, I heard two different radio guys make this same argument. So I'm not quoting. I know I've got quotes up there, but this is not an actual quote. It's more of a paraphrase. But this gives you the idea. Judas betrayed Jesus because, really, in his mind, Jesus had betrayed him first. Judas Iscariot. Iscariot comes from the word Sicarii, and the Sicarii, they were zealots. They were assassin types that were associated with the zealots. Judas expected Jesus to be this military Messiah who would throw off the shackles of Rome and finally bring Israel back to greatness. But when Jesus didn't turn out to be that kind of Messiah, Judas was all too glad to betray him. Well, is there any truth to this idea, any merit at all? Let's talk about the Sicarii, or Sicarius is the singular, Sicarii, or we could just say Sicariuses, I guess, since this is English. But those folks actually did exist. A Sicca, this comes from Colley Caldwell's commentary on Luke. A Sicca was a small curved sword that could be easily concealed and quickly used, and even in the midst of the crowd, they would sort of go into the middle of a crowd and they would stab somebody and get away before anybody could realize what was going on. You know, in the sudden commotion, you could just slip away and nobody would know who did it. Well, the Sicarii, I should say, they originally were after the Romans, but in time they came also to target those Jews who also sided with the Romans or were somehow sympathetic to the Romans. So they would assassinate these guys in order to strike fear into them and stir up chaos. And let me also point to a passage here in Josephus's Antiquities of the Jews. Now this is in AD 58. So in other words, it's not when he wrote it, but rather this is the time period he's talking about. Upon Festus's coming to Judea, it happened that Judea was afflicted by robbers, while all the villages were set on fire and plundered by them. And then it was that the Sicarii, our friends here, they, as they were called, who were robbers, grew too numerous. He goes on to mention them a few more times. So then, the Sicarii really did exist. Is it possible? Is it possible that Judas had some sort of a loftier motive, that he had some sort of a national pride, and that he was trying, that what he was really acting from was that he was trying to throw off the shackles of Rome and restore Israel to prominence? Well, I don't think so. First, let me point out to you, let me back up and show you this first. Note that this was from AD 58, that this quote from Josephus comes from. In other words, about 30 years after Jesus even walked the earth. This is the first mention that Josephus makes of these folks. It was possible that they were around earlier and even about the time of Jesus' ministry, but at the very best, if I can put it that way, they may have been over in literal Rome. They were not spread throughout the empire. These appear to be a relatively late phenomenon, is what I'm getting at. How is it going to be that Judas could have been a part of a gang, a group, that really most likely did not exist at the time that Jesus walked to the earth? So then, having said that, let's look at another, and I think the more likely explanation. I told you to go to Luke, but we want to go to Joshua chapter 15. Joshua chapter 15 is where we see the name Kerioth mentioned. Now this is in the midst of Joshua and Eleazar dividing up the land, and we see a city by the name of Kerioth mentioned. Now, I won't give you, I'm not going to pronounce all those cities there, but the long and the short is it was down in the southern portion of Judah. It was toward the border of Edom in the south, according to Joshua 15, verse 21. And so really, the better explanation of who Judas Iscariot was, Iscariot is probably from the Hebrew word ish for man, and then Kerioth, which is this city here. It's much more likely that name was Iscariot. You see that, you hear the similarity? I mean, Iscariot, Sicarii, well, there's some similarity there, but Iscariot, that sounds a lot more like Iscariot. So that's the more likely explanation there. In fact, let me get you to turn to another passage. Take a look at John chapter 6, verse 71. John chapter 6, verse 71. This will read a little bit different depending on which translation you're using. John chapter 6, verse 71. In John 6:71, my New King James reads this way. He spoke of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. But some translations, in fact, some Greek texts actually read this way. He spoke slightly differently, I should say. Rather than saying he spoke of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, we have rather this. He spoke of Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And you can get that by looking at the endings of the words. The possessive or the genitive case is assigned both to Iscariot and to Simon. And so it's more likely that the Iscariot in John 6 verse 71 goes not with Judas, but rather with Simon. Well, if that's the case, now we have a Judas Iscariot and we also have a Simon Iscariot. Is it more likely that you have these two men, father and son, who both belonged to a band of assassins? Or is it more likely that both father and son were men from Kerioth? Judas is Judas from Kerioth and Simon from Kerioth. That seems much more likely. So then, having dealt with the name, I mean, really the name is the only thing that we have to go on here. In fact, we have a particular, I remember when I first heard this, this theory, I thought, wait a second, we've got another apostle, Simon, and he's actually called a zealot. You'd think that if Judas were in fact a zealot, they would call him a zealot. So when you take away the name and trying to tie in the name Iscariot with these Sicarii, the assassins, you really don't have anything to base this theory on. And yet, I can sympathize. You know, you see somebody who spends 3 years in the company of the Son of God and sees him do all the things that he does. In fact, Judas, being one of the 12 apostles, his closest disciples, is even able to go and cast out demons himself. You would think that somebody like that, how can he do that? How can he talk himself into betraying his Lord on his own somehow? There must have been some greater purpose. You know, we wouldn't want to condone it, but you could see if there were some way that we could find some sort of a national pride, some greater purpose than himself motivating Judas. Well, again, you wouldn't condone it, but you'd sort of understand. And yet, there doesn't seem to be any either scriptural or historical evidence for that. So with that, let's move on to our second theory. Now, we were traveling a few years ago and attended worship with a church in the area. And I have to admit, I can't remember what the Bible class as a whole was on. But somehow we got to talking about Judas, and there was a fellow who spoke up there, and this is, again, I'm paraphrasing here. I didn't notice words exactly, but it was something like this. He says, look, I believe in free will, but it seems to me that if anyone who did what Judas did would never have acted on his own. He was possessed or something. If there was a single person in history who acted or who was not acting of his own free will, surely it was Judas. Okay, so Judas, he was not acting on his own. Is it possible? Now let's turn to Luke. Sorry about leading you astray earlier. Turn to Luke 22, verses 1 through 4. So let me pile on here just a little bit. Is it possible that there is some merit to this theory? Luke chapter 22, verses 1 through 4. Now at the feast of the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover, and the chief priests and scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Now look here. Then Satan entered Judas, named Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So he went his way and conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him to them. So is it possible? I mean, do we have scriptural evidence here? I mean, Satan entered Judas. What, how much clearer could it be? Judas was somehow possessed and Satan made him do it. Well, let's deal with it this way. When Stephen was doing his lessons on Calvinism here a year or two ago, he shared this quote, and he was nice enough to give me this quote to remind me what this quote was. So this is from Austin Fisher and Scott McKnight. In case that's too small there, this comes from the book Young, Restless, and No Longer Reformed. In other words, these guys used to be 5-point Calvinists, but they no longer believe that. And they are writing about why they have moved away from the ideas of Calvinism. And this is one of the quotes from the book here. Looking for free will in the Bible is like looking for gravity. It's assumed everywhere and holds everything together, so you probably won't notice it until it's missing and you float away. In other words, it's not that the Bible so much comes out and states, yes, there is such a thing as free will. But the language that it uses, you can't avoid it. It's kind of like in the political realm, people talk about, well, is there such a thing as property rights? Is it even right to own property? Well, it's not that the Bible comes out and says, yes, it is right to own property, but the fact that there is a law that says you shall not steal implies, well, then yes, if I can't own something, then nobody can steal it from me. Well, by the same token, when we look at some passages here, you're going to see how, well, it's not so much that it says man has free will, but if he doesn't have free will, none of these passages make any sense. So let's look at several passages here. All through the Bible. Go back to Deuteronomy. Advanced a little too quickly here. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 30, and let's look at verse 19. This, of course, is we're nearing the end of Moses' life, and he's been delivering these speeches there on the plains of Moab, and he's told them about all of the things that God will do for them if they will just be faithful, and he's told them about all of the havoc that God is going to wreak and vengeance that he's going to bring down upon them if they are not faithful. And so he says, Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19, he says, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that both you and your descendants may live. So there we are. If it's impossible for a man to make the choice, why is Moses posing the choice? We're all familiar with Joshua chapter 24. It's been a memory verse in classes that I've been in classes I've taught. Joshua 24 verses 14 and 15. Now therefore fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So again, there it is. Moses says, I've given you life and death. Choose life. Joshua says, choose whom this day whom you will serve. And obviously is trying to encourage them, serve the Lord. All the way at the end of the Bible. I keep doing that. All the way at the end of the Bible, Revelation 22. Of course, we've had all of these vivid vivid series of visions, but this vivid series of scenes unfolding in a vision before John. And at the very end of the book, in verse 17, Revelation 22, verse 17, and the Spirit and Bride say, come, and let him who hears say, come, and let him who thirsts come. Whoever desires, or your translation, if you've got the King James, may say wills. Whoever wills, that's the same idea there. Whoever desires or wills, let him take the water of life freely. So there it is again. If I don't have the ability to exercise my will and either choose to take of that water of life or to refuse it, then I don't have free will. It's assumed. And let's go all the way back to the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis chapter 4. Remember what God said when he was talking to Cain. Cain was downcast because God did not accept his sacrifice. But God, in trying to cheer him up in verse 7, Genesis chapter 4, verse 7, he says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Again, Cain, if you don't have the capacity to buck up and live right, well then, why is God even giving him this choice? So I think we can say from the beginning to the end, there is no question as to whether the Bible presents or paints the picture that man has free will. And so it would be very strange for one man in all of the Bible, not to be able to exercise his free will on this occasion. Let me throw at you one more verse. This is Matthew 23, verse 37. And if I may say so, if I can put it this way, it's my favorite verse for dealing with this idea. Matthew 23, verse 37. This is after Jesus has excoriated the Pharisees and the scribes, and now he laments over Jerusalem at their intransigence. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. This is Matthew 23, verse 37. Now, I want you to pay attention to this. If man does not have free will, these words make no sense. In fact, if man does not have free will, and I know how this sounds coming out of my mouth, but I'm going to say it anyway. If man does not have free will, then we serve a mad God. Okay? In other words, if man does not have free will, if the only way that I can submit to Jesus is because he somehow twiddles some bits in my heart so that I can finally serve Him, if the only way I can serve Him is if He allows me to serve Him, is if He makes me serve Him by His sovereign will, then these words are madness. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. I wanted to, but you weren't willing. You mean Jesus? You're the sovereign God. It's in your hands as to whether this person can even act to serve you or not. You say you want him, but then you're the one withholding him the will to be able to do that. Again, if man does not have free will, these words make no sense at all. And this is madness. So I think we have to say, the Bible, it makes it very clear. All of mankind has free will. Okay, having said that, is it possible? Certainly unlikely. Is it even possible that perhaps Judas could somehow not have been acting on his free will? In other words, I'm arguing from the general to the particular, but is it possible that we do have one exception to the case? Well, let me direct you to same book in the book of Matthew, direct you to one more passage here. And this is Matthew 27, verses 3 and 4. When we have a family member, and of course we've had this kind of thing here, when you have a family member who is suffering from some sort of disease or malady that changes that person's personality. You have a man or woman who is formerly very mild-mannered, very, very good, you know, the picture of a Christian, if you will. And then in the throes of this disease, that person gets violent, gets angry, calls people names. You hear that person use language you've never heard come out of that person's mouth. Do we charge that person with sin? No. We recognize that that person has been robbed of his faculties or hers. Okay? So read with me Matthew 27, verses 3 and 4. If Judas was robbed of his ability to be able to act on his own, again, these words make no sense. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful. Again, are those folks remorseful? Well, sometimes if you're in a situation where the throes of the disease sort of come and go, but Judas says he was remorseful. He brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And the record does not contradict him here. It does not say, well, Judas thought he sinned, but he hadn't. No, the record lets it stand. Judas had sinned. If Judas was acting not on his own free will, if he was being compelled by the devil and unable to resist, then we could not say that Judas had sinned. We're only guilty of things that we choose to do ourselves. And that I think is what makes the warning that Jesus placed before Judas when he began to tell them, "One of you is going to betray me." He says, "It would have been better if that man had not been born." That's what makes it all the more haunting. It wasn't that Judas was born to play a part that he could not resist, but rather he was born to play a part that he took full advantage of, but he took full part in. He played the part of his own free will. Let's look at something else. Now, what does possession look like in the Bible? So I think we've dealt with the fact that, or the idea that Judas perhaps was not acting on his own free will. I think he was. I don't think we can prove that he wasn't. So let's also look at something else. You're going to claim that somehow Judas was possessed here. Well, what does possession look like when we see it in other places? Turn to Mark chapter 1. And we'll also look at chapter 5 here in just a moment. Mark chapter 1, verses 23 and 24. I want you to look at how people who are possessed in the New Testament behave. And then we want to contrast that with Judas. Okay? So here we have Mark chapter 1, verse 23 and 24. "There was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, 'Let us alone. What are we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God.'" Now, it does seem a little bit strange that you would have somebody confessing that he's the Son of God, and yet I think we see the way that Jesus deals with these people, these unclean spirits were basically trying to give Jesus a bad name, and so he shuts them down quickly. But look at where this man was. Do demons come to synagogues? Do demons want to be in the company of the righteous? Do demons want to be in the company of God? No, they want to be anywhere but. And so we have a man who was possessed, and yet he apparently still had the willpower. He still could act on his own, and he could make himself go to the synagogue where he could receive spiritual nourishment. Similarly, Mark chapter 5, verses 2 through 7. This is the man who was in the tombs, who was possessed of an unclean spirit. And when he had come out of the boat, that is Jesus, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit who had his dwelling among the tombs. And no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been pulled apart by him and the shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him. And he cried out with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me." So again, here we have somebody who was not in Jesus' presence, but when Jesus came near, that fellow ran up to meet Jesus. Well, what is the picture here? Here, I think the picture that we have is when an unclean spirit, a demon, possessed someone in the New Testament, it would overpower him at times, and yet we have somebody who can fight back, if you will, and go to synagogue, and go to Jesus, and come to him for healing. And I think the picture's clear. We have a problem. We have a problem, sin, that we can resist. We fall to it sometimes, we can resist it, and we can even master it for some time, but we have to go to Jesus to receive that full atonement. Okay? So I think that's the picture of possession. Struggle, and then going to Jesus to be cleansed of your atonement. Now, having said that, this picture of those who were possessed, who were always struggling with this, and sometimes being overpowered, but having the ability to fight back at times as well. Is that what we see in Judas? Is that what we see there? Let's look. Stay in the book of Mark, chapter 14. We want to look at verses 10 and 11. Mark 14, verses 10 and 11. Then Judas Iscariot, in Mark 14 there. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray him, and when they heard it, they were glad, and promised him money. So he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Now, does that look like a man who's putting up a struggle? We have the account of an unclean spirit possessing a boy and throwing him to the ground, causing him to foam at the mouth, throwing him into the fire or into the water. Do we see that picture of struggle there in Judas? No. We see Judas going right along with this. It was not that Satan somehow overpowered Judas's will, but rather Satan worked right along with Judas's will. Judas was not possessed. But we still have this idea of Satan entering Judas. Well, how do we deal with that? What does that mean? Well, let's look at some similar language in John chapter 14. John chapter 14. So it says that Satan entered Judas. Well, in John chapter 14, we have some similar language that Jesus uses about himself and about the Father. Judas, not Iscariot, John chapter 14, verse 22, by the way. I think it's ironic that it's the not Iscariot Judas. It's probably the guy we know as Thaddeus in other places. But it says, Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, "Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world?" Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." Now, do we look at those words and say, okay, well, see, these people whom Jesus and the Father, whom they make their, they enter these people and they are no longer acting of their own free will. Do we argue that? Does anybody make that case from a passage like this? Or do we recognize that what it says first is, okay, before Jesus and the Father come and make their home in us, what have we got to do? We've got to love Jesus and we've got to keep his word. If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and, in other words, then, if you will, then my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. So what does that mean? How can Satan enter Judas and Jesus and the Father enter us? What does that mean insofar as influence goes? Well, I think it means the same thing in both cases. In neither case is it that we are somehow robbed of our will, and now it's somebody else acting on our behalf. No. In the case of Jesus and the Father, I love the Father, I love Jesus, and I keep their commandments. I am bowing, if you will, to their influence. I want to allow their influence to take root in me and to guide me. I want to live by their teaching. It's in no way robbing me of my will, but rather I am surrendering my will to theirs and doing what they want me to. Similarly, in the case of Judas, it's not that Judas somehow was robbed of his will, but rather Judas wanted to do wrong to begin with. I mean, can I put it this way, that Judas loved the devil in a sense there? I'm going to get ahead of myself. I can't let that go. So, but we'll see here in just a moment. Judas had something that he wanted to get a hold of, and it worked right along with what the devil wanted for him. And so Judas was all too willing to go along with that. Satan worked right along with his will and not against it. The same way that Jesus and the Father work with our wills when we surrender our wills to Him, to them, and not against us. So I think when we look at the fact that the Bible shows that all of us have free will and always have, we look at how what possession looks like and how that's not the same picture that we see in Judas. Judas went to the priests of his own volition. There was no struggle there. And then finally, this language of what it means when the Father, when Jesus, when the Spirit, for that matter, live in us. What does that mean? I think we've pretty well dealt with this idea of Satan entering Judas, and that somehow meaning that he had completely overpowered Judas so that Judas was unable to resist. So then, what was Judas's real motive? I mentioned we have to go to two passages. The first, John chapter 12, verses 3 through 6. John chapter 12, verses 3 through 6. And again, you can, if I can say one more thing about that last alternative theory, kind of like we'd like to be able to assign some sort of a higher purpose to Judas. Well, maybe he was compelled by national pride. Similarly, we'd like to find some way to explain away that Judas was anyway acting on his own. And we see here what was really going on. John chapter 12, verses 3 through 6. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" This he said not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. Also in Matthew chapter 26, take a look at verses 14 through 16. So very clearly, Judas was after money. This was what compelled him. And when he goes to the chief priests, what does he ask for? Matthew 26, verse 14. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you?" And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. I just don't think that the Holy Spirit could be any plainer here, that he has laid out in the record what motivated Judas. He's greedy. He wanted money. Now remember how I said I think that these two alternative theories will provide something of a foil so that we see the real danger in what Judas's actual motive was? Was he compelled to do something he didn't want to do already? No. In fact, let's think about some occasions when you have had men who were trying to do the right thing, and they just get hammered and worn down, or at least potentially worn down over time. Joseph. Was Judas in Joseph's place? You know, Joseph he's having to stave off his master's wife who keeps propositioning him and trying to seduce him day after day after day, and yet Joseph remained strong. That was not Judas. The priests were not coming to look for Judas. They were not coming to him day after day and saying, "Listen, can you just this once. Look what all we can give you." Balaam. You know, Balaam doesn't stay strong the way Joseph does. But Balaam, he had a king's ransom practically thrown at him. And that's when he finally gave in. But Judas, nobody was coming and throwing money at him. He went and sought the money out himself. The danger, what scares me, if I can put it that way, is that here you have a man who had a part of his life that he was not willing to surrender to God. He had a pet sin, if you will. Whereas he may have cleaned up all the rest of his life, he had this one little place where he said, I just want to hang on to this. Those of you who have seen the Lord of the Rings movies or read the books, you know, Gollum, he wants his precious. Nothing else matters if you can just hang on to this precious. Well, it's like we're telling God, look, you can have the rest of me. It's fine, but not this. Let me have this. I want this. You can't have it. And look what this did to Judas. If harboring greed, this little pet sin as I'm calling it, if harboring greed can make Judas betray the Son of God, do something that, I mean, can you imagine if you had asked Judas beforehand, do you think that you would, when God's Messiah comes on the scene, would you ever betray him? No. I mean, we have Peter saying something similar. I'll never abandon you, Lord. Never deny you. And yet look what it made Judas do. So don't think that hanging on to some piece of your life that you don't want to turn over fully to God can't lead you to do the same thing. For Judas, it was greed. We hear about preachers who are caught with pornography. We hear about deacons who take from the collection. That sort of thing. Why does that happen? Because there's an area of their life that they're just not willing to give over to God. And they tell themselves, it's okay. I can keep it under control and everything will be fine. Well, with Judas, it wasn't fine. And don't think that it can't be the same way with you. So then, let me ask you, am I talking to you? Are you harboring some pet sin that you're not, you just don't really want to turn this over? What does Jesus say in Mark chapter 9? Cut it off. Pluck your eye out, cut your hand off, cut your foot off. It's not worth it. Whatever it is you're hanging on to, it is not worth it. I'm telling you. Are you going to, if you put the scales here, whatever you're hanging on to, are you really going to tip the scales in favor of this thing, or do the scales tip in favor of eternity? I'm telling you, it's not worth it. So whatever it is you may be hanging on to, get rid of that. Let us know. And you don't have to tell everybody here, but tell some of us and let us pray with you. Let us help you work that out. And if you're not a Christian, I'm telling you, whatever you're holding back is not worth it. Again, you've got eternity on the line. Whatever is holding you back from coming forward and rendering obedience to the gospel, you'll forget about that in time. When you face the judge, you will forget that you ever desired that at all. So can we help you this evening somehow? If you'd like to be, if you'd like for us to pray with you and help you deal with that pet sin, let us know. And if you'd like to be baptized into Jesus, please let us know this evening as we stand and sing.